This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, NPR environmental correspondent Nathan Rott weighs in on California's changing environment.
All of the projections of what's going to happen to the California coastline over the next 20, 30 years are pretty dire and pretty scary.
Also, local animal shelters on the Central Coast are full.
I always say that no matter how nice a shelter is, it's still a shelter.
For sure.
You know, it's not a home.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 18th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with a series on PTSD and homelessness from the KCBX newsroom. It's called Breaking the Cycle, and it was produced as a project for the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's 2023 Data Fellowship.
I'm Gabriela Fernandez. Nearly half of the unhoused people in San Luis Obispo County who answered a question about PTSD, or post-traumatic stress disorder, reported having it, according to the region's 2022 point-in-time count. In the first part of her series, Breaking the Cycle, KCBX's Amanda Wernick explains what the mental disorder is and how it can lead to a cycle of homelessness.
I'm going to meet Chad Lamb. He lives in supportive housing run by Transitions Mental Health Association, or TEMA, a local nonprofit.
Hi, my name's Amanda.
I'm Chad.
Nice to meet you. I'm Lori.
The housing program offers homeless people a safe place to live while getting treated for mental health issues.
It's real difficult coming in off the streets after 15 years because you always have that doubt and waiting for the other shoe to drop.
TEMA recently diagnosed Lamb with PTSD, a mental health condition that can develop after experiencing a traumatic event like abuse or an accident. Lamb says when he was a child, his father physically abused him.
I've been beaten with cattle prods, welding rods, stingers. He's beat me unconscious. He's broken my bones for a few times.
He says he also started drinking and using drugs at a young age. Lori Eister, a therapist with TEMA, says many people with PTSD are always on edge, feeling like they're under threat even when they're not.
What happens in the brain when people go through trauma is fight, flight, or freeze. Our brains tell us that we're in danger. So people who have PTSD, their filters for danger don't work like people who don't have PTSD. So their brains are constantly saying danger, danger, danger.
Lamb says he's starting to feel safe in TEMA's housing program.
It's been a struggle, but I'm actually pretty grateful because now I have some place to be.
More than half of the people in the PIT survey who said they have PTSD reported being hurt or abused as a child, nearly double the rate of people who didn't report having PTSD. He says when he turned 17, his father left him, which forced him to live on the streets. From there, he describes his life as a blur, marked by periods of jail time, living in and out of shelters, and sustaining a traumatic brain injury from a fight. But there's one childhood memory that haunts him vividly.
At age 4, I shot and killed my brother because of my father's ignorance. He didn't clear the weapons.
Lamb says he and his brother were playing in his dad's work storage room when they stumbled upon a rifle on the top shelf. He climbed up to get it. He says he still gets flashbacks of his brother lying lifeless on the ground.
His last words to me are still echoing in my head, you know, and it's very haunting. It can be very triggering at times.
Lamb says his PTSD symptoms have contributed to his long-term homelessness.
I don't deal well with society because of my life, and it makes it super hard to be a part of anything.
In the PIT count, the most common reasons people with PTSD reported experiencing homelessness were COVID-related issues and job loss. Another big reason was their family and friends couldn't let them stay, or they had an argument with family, friends, or roommates. Eister explains that people with PTSD often struggle to maintain stable commitments because they constantly see threats in every aspect of their lives.
any little bump in the road, their reaction to it can be a big blow up, which has caused them to be not welcome in so many places, right? Not welcome at the job, not welcome in the family, not welcome at the shelter, not welcome anywhere.
Lamb says that with the help of Tima, he's confronting his trauma and staying sober. But he spent 15 years of on and off homelessness before he reached this point. Part two of the series looks into why people with PTSD often face recurring homelessness and the hurdles they encounter in accessing help. For KCBX News, I'm Amanda Wernick.
In the second part of her series, Breaking the Cycle, KCBX's Amanda Wernick explores how PTSD and homelessness can create a reinforcing cycle that makes it harder for people to get help.
Since PTSD can make it hard for people to maintain stable commitments and relationships, many with the disorder end up homeless. But then, living outdoors in places not meant for human habitation often exposes people to traumatic events such as theft and violence, which can worsen existing PTSD. Lori Eister, a therapist with Transitions Mental Health Association, or TEMA, says that the inherent trauma of living on the streets can even cause people to develop CPTSD, a more severe form of the disorder.
Complex PTSD means that this person has been through repeated chronic trauma over and over and over.
Eister explains that the longer someone is homeless, the more trauma they experience, which can lead to symptoms like depression, aggressiveness, and dissociation. I'm with the City Mobile Crisis Unit to check up on Daniel Brainerd, who has been homeless for about a decade.
What's up, Daniel?
Yeah, you're catching me at a real melancholy point in time.
Brainerd shares he's in a rough spot, mourning the loss of a friend. I ask him if he plans to seek help or has any hope for the future.
No. Every time I try, I get shot down. And that is demoralizing, depressing, and make you suicidal. So I don't try. No ambitions, you know, no disappointment.
People like Brainerd, who have been homeless for a long time, can adopt what Eister calls a failure response.
It's where people have been down for so long and they expect to fail at things.
A homeless person showing a failure response avoids seeking help. Then this keeps them unhoused longer, exposing them to more trauma and worsening their mental health, which makes them less likely to seek help, continuing the cycle. Eister says failure response can also cause people who are no longer homeless or are close to getting back on their feet to slip back into homelessness.
They'll get almost to success. They'll almost get that job, or they'll almost have 30 days clean and sober, and then they'll blow it up.
In the PIT survey, people who reported having PTSD were over 40% more likely to experience being homeless more than once than those without the disorder.
They're not going to be able to keep relationships. They're not going to be able to keep income. And all of these things just return them back to homelessness over and over and over.
Chad Lamb was homeless on and off for about 15 years. He's diagnosed with PTSD and now lives in TEMA supportive housing. But it took a lot of almosts for him to get to this point. Lamb recalls the first time he managed to stay sober for 2 weeks. Things were finally starting to look up for him after years of struggling. But then he relapsed from grieving the loss of his friend.
It's just the fact that I actually had a connection with another human being that was so deep that it affected me really bad.
Lamb says it was tough to even consider getting help for his mental health and substance abuse issues when he constantly faced tragic events like loss and violence while living outdoors. Crystal Rassicott is a case manager with TEMA who works with clients like Lamb. She reveals that she was once homeless herself due to experiencing PTSD from domestic abuse. Despite these challenges, Rassicott eventually found help through county mental health services.
It's not an easy thing to get into county mental health because you have to make all those appointments. They cancel. It's a different doctor every time you go there, and so you have to start your story over again.
Rassicott also points out that people who are already dealing with trauma and exhaustion often struggle to keep track of their appointments.
The main barrier I see with homelessness is lack of phones, lack of being able to wake up at normal times, know what time it is during the day to make their appointments.
Despite facing mental and physical barriers, Lamb was able to access services and says TEMA is helping him get on the right path. For KCBX News, I'm Amanda Wernick.
In the final episode of the series, Wernick explores how a local organization is helping unhoused people break this cycle.
Chad Lamb recalls one of the lowest moments of being homeless for over a decade. As rain poured down on his tent, he said he felt the heavy burden of numbing his PTSD symptoms with drugs and alcohol. He says police soon showed up at the Bob Jones Trail to tell Lamb he had to leave. He found himself on all fours, packing up his belongings. At that moment, he had a realization.
I can't do this anymore. I'm too old for this.
Lamb was almost 50. This wasn't another tough night for him. He says it was a turning point.
The determination to want to stop being high, to want to be a part of something, to basically want to feel anything other than anger and hatred all the time.
Lamb has been living in supportive housing provided by Transitions Mental Health Association, or TEMA, for a couple of years. He's sober. Here, he has a safe place to live and gets treatment for his PTSD.
They helped me observe myself in different ways that I wasn't able to.
A team of health professionals and specialists working with TEMA's Housing Now program focuses on helping the most vulnerable individuals who are at high risk of dying on the streets. Eister says TEMA is at the forefront of the statewide housing first approach to combat homelessness in San Luis Obispo County.
Most programs say you can come into housing once you're sober, once you're on medication for your mental illness. We say you can come into housing now and we'll work on those things as we go along.
Partnering with TEMA, the San Luis Obispo City Mobile Crisis Unit, or MCU, hits the road to locate unhoused individuals.
Seatbelt. There you go.
Scott Guillaume, a caseworker with the MCU, points out that treating mental health problems becomes difficult when people are in survival mode while living in the streets.
These guys are hyper-vigilant through the night, not sleeping very well because typically they may or may not be attacked and their stuff stolen.
Eister explains that once clients no longer have to worry about surviving, they can finally start paying attention to what's happening in their own brains.
They sleep. They're finally safe. They can finally shut the door. They can lock the door.
Eister helps clients with PTSD work through their past traumas.
I practice EMDR, which stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
In EMDR sessions, Eister says people talk about tough memories while doing something to activate their brain, like moving their eyes from side to side. Studies suggest this may be similar to how our brains process memories during REM sleep. It helps integrate the bad memories into the past so they bother us less in the present. For people with PTSD, this could mean fewer flashbacks or other disruptive symptoms. Eister says she focuses on helping clients change their negative thinking habits.
If you could hear the self-talk that goes on in the minds of these people, it's pretty terrible the way they treat themselves, right? So it starts there, like, hey, pay attention to the way you're internally talking to yourself and try to be more kind and try to be more gentle.
Crystal Rassicott, who manages the Housing Now program, says it's been incredible to see the positive changes in residents' lives.
I love those guys. It's fun just seeing how they went from rock bottom to working and being clean and looking great and mentally being better. So it's definitely rewarding.
Lamb says working with mental health specialists at TEMA has changed his outlook on life.
It's one of the hardest lessons to learn. And once you start to open up your mind, you'll hear things better. Once you start to open up your heart, you'll feel compassion, empathy.
TEMA stands out as one of the few organizations in the county that tackles homelessness from all angles. Alongside the Housing Now program, they offer group support, help finding employment, and family services. TEMA's combination of supportive housing and mental health treatment plays a pivotal role in changing individual lives and breaking the cycle of homelessness. For KCBX News, I'm Amanda Wernick.
This piece was produced as a project for the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's 2023 Data Fellowship. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Earlier this month, NPR environmental correspondent Nathan Rott met with KCBX listeners at an event in San Luis Obispo. Here's KCBX's Kim Foster speaking with Rott to discuss California's changing environment and his reporting in Ukraine.
Welcome, and let's talk about your reporting in California. Huge state to cover, lots of things happening in California. Most recently, the weather. How much have you been reporting on the weather and everything that's been happening in California lately?
Quite a bit, yeah. So I'm on NPR's climate desk, and a big part of that is covering, yeah, whether it's raining, whether it's snowing, whether it's sunny, whether there's smoke in the air, or you name it. So a lot of what I've been doing lately is covering the atmospheric rivers that we've been getting kind of slogged with one after another all winter, and just reporting on some of the, you know, rock slides, debris flows, flooding, all of that stuff. And I live in Ventura now. So in Ventura, in the Central Coast, as you guys well know, has been just getting hammered with a lot of this stuff. So it's convenient, I guess, in that way. I don't have to travel a whole heck of a long ways to do my reporting. But yeah, I've been doing a lot of that and kind of just, you know, talking about what the effects are, and then also just spelling out for people the climate connection, whether or not climate change is playing a role in any of the kind of more intense events that we're seeing all over across California every year.
So the news is coming to you.
Yeah, it turns out. Not something you usually want, but... But yeah, no, it's been a pretty wild winter, and we had a really wild one last year too. So it's kind of, you know, it seems like one after another, and that's just par for the course in California, is one extreme to another, it seems like.
Exactly. We even had tornadoes up here, you know, which we've never had really in the last 20 years. So it was interesting. And how much is this contributed to climate change?
Yeah, so I mean, with atmospheric rivers, it's a lot more complicated than it is with, say, like wildfires, right? Like, so wildfires, droughts, you know, there's a ton of peer-reviewed science that makes it very clear that, you know, human-caused climate change is making wildfires worse or making droughts more frequent, all that. And with the atmospheric rivers, it's complicated. So I've spent a lot of time talking to the folks at Scripps at UCSD about a lot of the research that they've been doing, and other folks. The University of Arizona has done some good research on it. And, you know, the general consensus is that we know that hot air holds more moisture. And we know that the air is hotter because of all the emissions that we've put into the atmosphere for driving our cars and heating our homes and doing all that. And so there's an expectation that that atmospheric rivers are going to get more intense, are going to hold more moisture and drop more rain and precipitation over time, but that has not been observed yet. So I know a lot of research has been going on. There's a lot of research that's going on currently that is probably going to show that connection and say, so we could say when I get on the air that, hey, these atmospheric rivers are getting more intense because of climate change, but because there has not been the peer-reviewed science yet that, you know, explicitly spells that out, it's something that we try to be careful about saying, just because we want to be as accurate as possible and make sure that people are getting the right information.
Well, and you have some unique experience having been a firefighter and seeing the increase of fire and firestorms, you know, especially here in California. I mean, have you noticed since you've been not a firefighter anymore, but reporting on fires, that things have changed?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you talk to any firefighter, and I've talked to buddies who were still in it and still doing it. You know, I worked on an initial attack crew in Montana through college and a little bit after. And we put out, you know, everything from small acre fire to something the size of your living room, you know, like basically the quick starts we try to get out and tamp down before they get too big. And the thing that you just kind of hear repeatedly talking to firefighters now is that the conditions are such that fires just get so much more intense so fast. And, you know, a big thing that I hear a lot is that, you know, at nighttime, that used to be kind of the time where you could do night operations. So you could, you know, if you're trying to build line around a fire, you're trying to get some heat out of a fire, night is a great time to do it because relative humidities go up, the temperatures typically go down, and, you know, the fire activity really kind of hampers down, right? And that just isn't happening like it was before. Like, it's hotter at night. The relative humidities are not recovering like they usually do, so it's still dry. So you still get some pretty aggressive fire behavior. We used to always call it going apey. You know, a fire going a little apey at night. And that's certainly a thing that I think a lot of people are dealing with. And I miss wildland firefighting a lot. It was a great job. But I definitely don't, I feel bad for the guys that are still doing it, and the guys and gals, because it is it's gotten really difficult.
Yeah, and fire can create its own weather. And that's why you have those unique firestorms. I covered the Bay Area, fire in Oakland and some of the other fires a few years ago. And the weather conditions and the, you know, Santa Ana winds and all those other things that contribute to it can make getting out of a fire, a dangerous situation, difficult.
Big thing, like I've covered the Thomas fire, you know, that happened down here in Ventura County, LA County. I covered the Napa fires in 2016. And, you know, there's been every year. I mean, we've been lucky, right? The last 2 years have not been quite as crazy as some of the years that we saw before. I know that's a big concern that people had earlier this winter just because of the lack of snowpack, which is being resolved right now with all the atmospheric rivers we're seeing. But yeah, it's a, you know, fire behavior has changed, and it's creating all sorts of stressors for the folks that are trying to put these things out, and the managers that are trying to deal with them, and the, you know, energy providers that are trying to figure out what to do with their power lines and all that. It's really changed the dynamic for folks and causing a lot of stress for people too. I mean, think about how many people get evacuated every year because of wildfires, and how many people suffer from power outages because, you know, their transmission line gets knocked down. Or, and shoot, we did a story. I did a story with some colleagues last year about just the insurance picture in California and how hard it's getting for people to get homeowners insurance now because of the wildfire risk. And those are, you know, it's a big deal. It's you can't sign a mortgage for a house if you can't get it insured. So it's a really big issue for people.
Yeah, and the coast of California as well, erosion. We've having a lot of problems with that. And to the rains. I mean, I'm sure you see that in Ventura, that the California coast is dwindling.
Since I moved to California, I grew up in Montana, but I moved to California and thought, like, I'm going to lose my mind if I don't find some way to get out and exercise and do something cool. So I picked up surfing, which I'm sure every surfer is going to hear this and say, thanks, great. Yeah, another dude in the water. But you know, it's wild just doing that and being out and seeing how much the beach changes every winter with the sand being sucked away, the sand being redeposited. I mean, in Ventura Surfer Point, where I go all the time, you can see the parking lot there. They've had to close big chunks of it just because there's so much erosion that's happened there. And that's, you know, all of the projections of what's going to happen to the California coastline over the next 20, 30 years are pretty dire and pretty scary. It's just going to take away a lot of public beaches. It's going to take away a lot of public access. It's going to threaten a lot of homes. And that's a bummer because, I mean, it's, I don't need to tell you, you know, California coasts are one of the prettiest places on earth. And so it's a bummer to think that it's going to be a very different and denuded kind of landscape probably in the future.
Mm-hmm. We definitely see that here on the Central Coast for sure. But what can be done? I mean, does it have to come from the national level, the state level, the local level, or a combination of all of those? I know the Coastal Commission here in California is trying to protect everything, but it's sort of a race against time, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say D all of the above, right? Like what I run into all the time, and I feel kind of stupid after a while saying it on the radio over and over and over again. But I mean, the easiest solution for a lot of these things, whether it's biodiversity loss, whether it's wildfires, whether it's coastal erosion, is to just quit contributing to climate change. Right. So like basically trying to change our economy and figure out how to, you know, quit putting so much pollutants into the atmosphere and different gases, methane, carbon dioxide, things that are warming the planet. That's the easiest solution. I mean, it's the most difficult solution, but it's also the simplest, right? If you quit contributing to the problem, you'll see, you know, less intense effects. And you know, like there's a lot of heating that's baked into the system right now, right? Like, we're going to see climate change continue, even if we did miraculously somehow decide to cut all of our emissions tomorrow. It's the world is a dynamic place and it's going to continue to warm. But, you know, every fraction of a degree warmer has very different implications for wildfires and for drought and for all these things that we're talking about.
Must be interesting to report on it, though. You're witnessing history, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It can be pretty darn depressing at times, just because, you know, I love our natural resources in California. I love the natural resources we have in the U.S. And, you know, I spent a bunch of time hiking and camping and backpacking and fishing in the Sierras and just seeing how much those mountains have changed. Even in the 10 years that I've been in California, it's crazy. Just the tree die-offs and you know, ecosystems not recovering from wildfires the way they used to. And yeah, so it can be a pretty humbling and depressing thing to report on sometimes, but you got to try to stay optimistic and try to find solutions that people are implementing, whether it's on a local level or a national level, and try to take some hope from that.
Mm-hmm. You also report internationally as well. And I understand you went to Ukraine for a while and reported on quite a variety of issues there, including in the environment as well.
Yeah. So I, you know, when the full-scale conflict erupted in Ukraine in 2022, NPR had a bunch of my colleagues on the international desk were there. We had some other folks. And then, you know, over the last 2 years now, it's been over 2 years that full scale conflict's been going on. NPR was cycling folks through that, you know, were willing to volunteer to go and do the reporting there. And I've always wanted to kind of be a foreign correspondent. You know, I think back to when I was doing wildland firefighting and, you know, like smoke jumpers are like the creme de la creme, you know, the top. And I was like, man, I want to do that someday. And I never did. And I think with reporting and being a journalist, I've always thought, you know, being a foreign correspondent is kind of the coolest, you know, it's like, that's kind of the top of the game sort of thing. And so it's something I've always wanted to do. And, you know, it's sad to say that it's taken a giant war in Europe for me to be able to kind of see some of that dream, but it was a really cool opportunity to go over. I've been over, I think, 4 times now to Ukraine for about a month each, little more depending on, or maybe it was 5, you know, a number of times I've been over to Ukraine doing some of the reporting on the conflict there and just trying to find ways to tell stories there that relate to people here in the U.S. The last time I went last year, I went over Thanksgiving in November. And I mean, you know, it's anybody watching the news knows that Ukraine is not the top news story anymore in the world. And so it's hard to find ways sometimes, I think, to find a story that kind of resonates with people and makes them think about what's going on over there. So you got to get kind of creative in your storytelling and figure out stories that, you know, might resonate with an audience mm-hmm. back home.
And you weren't worried at all? And being a journalist can be a dangerous job, you know, over there, especially.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, being a journalist, sadly, I think being a journalist can be a dangerous job now just about anywhere in the world. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think the way that I've kind of rationalized it, the way I talk about it with friends and family, you know, reporting in Ukraine, it feels a lot like covering a wildfire in some ways. And that, like, you know, you kind of know where the fire is, you know where the danger is, you know, to an extent, right? There's missile strikes, there's air alarms all the time in Ukraine, which you don't have as much control over. But, you know, you kind of know where the front lines are and you take your shots where you go and you do some reporting that's a little more, you know, type two reporting where it's a little more risky. But, you know, NPR's pretty good about, they have a setup with security advisors. So you're with somebody who can help kind of, who has experience in conflict zones, because, you know, I'm some climate reporter and schmuck. I don't know nothing. You know, the first time I went over there, I didn't know anything about artillery or how this works. And, but you get over there and you kind of understand, like, you get a little bit of more of a sense of the dynamic and places you can be that are a little risky. And what are the things you put in place to try to protect yourself and protect your team? Because you're not ever reporting on your own. I'm traveling with a driver, I'm traveling with a translator, I'm traveling with Ukrainians who know the country and know the place. And so just, you know, making sure you're doing everything you can to protect them, because I want to tell a good, impactful story, right? It's a good thing for me. It's a good thing for our audience. That's what we're supposed to do. But you have a lot of responsibility for other people while you're there too. And that's a thing I try to take really seriously, because, you know, nobody's getting paid enough to get killed in a conflict.
And you're wearing your bulletproof vest, I hope.
yeah, wearing the whole
40 kit. Pounds. Yeah, it's not fun.
Yeah, good way to lose some weight.
I know, sure. I know. But what kind of stories did you see there? I mean, the you must have seen devastation as well as hope, you know, with the people hoping that this will end at some point, you know.
Yeah, it's been interesting going, you know, I went in March of 2022. Full-scale conflict started in late February, so it was pretty early on. And we went to Kyiv not long after Ukraine had kind of pushed Russian troops out of the area. And we went to some of those. We went to Bucha and Irpin and some of these towns and areas that were occupied by Russian soldiers. And it was, I mean, yeah, it was hard to see. You know, you saw civilians, dead dog. I mean, you kind of name it. All the horrors you would imagine in a war zone are there and easy to see. But, you know, as I've gone back, I've tried to find, you know, like I was saying earlier, stories that would resonate with people in the U.S. So, you know, I cover biodiversity, I cover climate change. So when I was there, I was like, hey, let's do a story about some of the environmental destruction, degradation that's happened in the country. So we visited a national park down on the coast of the Black Sea, where they've been, you know, seeing washed up dead dolphins, and, you know, going to forests where they've, you know, artillery strikes have caused forest fires that have burned big areas, and talking to people there. And last time I was there, we went to in Sloviansk outside, so pretty far eastern Ukraine. We went and hung out with some folks with their environment ministry of Ukraine, and they're doing water monitoring and finding like heavy metals in some of the water there, which is unsurprising given all the artillery and all the ordnance that's been expended there. So doing stories like that, doing stories about the electrical grid, the energy grid, you know, that was a big thing that Russia tried to do in the first winter of the war. And this winter, too, is try to target energy infrastructure to try to make life just miserable for Ukrainians and kind of break the will of the country. But I also, you know, the idea of having a power outage is something that people in California have to deal with all the time, right? When we talk about wildfires and we talk about atmospheric rivers. So I do think that there's like, maybe hearing a person deal with that in Ukraine, even if the cause of it is completely different, it kind of builds a bridge, right, of trying to understand some of the things that people are dealing with there. And yeah, I think the last trip there was difficult in a lot of ways, just because it's 2 years of war and people are tired, you know, and people are exhausted and not really sure if it's going to end and how it's going to end. And I think that reality was, it's sobering and it's hard. And so just talking to people and feeling for them, you know, and trying to, you know, I'm a journalist, right? I'm not here to fix the thing. I'm not here to, you know, tell people it's going to get better. I'm not here, you know, but yeah, you end up kind of having to be almost a counselor for people when you talk to them sometimes.
Mm-hmm. But how important is it that we are there? That Western journalists are you're the eyes and ears showing us back home what's happening.
I mean, I think it's hugely important. I think, you know, the conflict in Gaza right now is a good example of it. There's just not as many report. I mean, you can't get in and out as a reporter. I mean, there's been some groups that have been able to do it either on an embed with IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, or with NGOs. But it's I think people need to understand the consequences of political decisions, the consequences of what's going on. And the way to do that is to have journalists there. And, you know, and look, a lot of this has changed. I feel like I learned a lot about the role of social media being in Ukraine and reporting on it there, because, you know, every soldier's got a smartphone, right? They're taking videos, or they've got got a GoPro on their helmet, and they're, you know, just the sheer amount of content, right? And I use content loosely, but just like of information that's being shared through some of these new channels. And I mean, that's a huge thing with Gaza, right? And what we're seeing there and in Israel, it's a lot of this, a lot of that is not quote unquote journalists, it's citizens just recording stuff and sharing it. And then And then it's up to journalists to verify it, to try to locate, you know, do all the legwork to prove that what we're seeing or what we're hearing is true, right? Or that it's valid. And yeah, I mean, I think it's hugely important. And I, you know, being a reporter is, it's an interesting job in the U.S. because I don't, we're not, it's not as universally kind of, I mean, and I don't think at any point in history, people were like, man, journalism, that is the coolest job. And that is such an important thing in the world, you know, but you go to Ukraine and holy moly, man, people are excited to talk to you and they understand it's important that the U.S. understands what's going on because we've been supplying them with a lot of aid over the last 2 years. And so, you know, they know it's important that, that Americans are getting information about what's happening. And then can decide, right, politically, whether or not we want to continue to support or help or any of that. So I think it's an incredibly important thing. And it's it feels good. You leave a trip like that feeling like you did something good, which is what we want to feel in journalism all the time. Right. That we're educating people, that we're helping people understand the world around them. And going to places that are hard to get to or dangerous to be in, like Ukraine, is I think is just hugely important.
That was NPR environmental correspondent Nathan Rott speaking with KCBX's Kim Foster. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, peace, love, and pets.
Welcome to KCBX Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. This is Peace, Love, and Pets. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society. By now, you have probably heard me talk about how overcrowded the shelters are these days and how the demand for pets in need unfortunately just keeps growing. Today, my guest is Sarah Aguilar, the director at Santa Barbara County Animal Services. Santa Barbara County Animal Services recently posted a video on social media showing that their three locations were quite literally overflowing with pups in need and had no open kennels. Sarah, welcome to Peace, Love, and Pets.
Hi, Robin.
Hey.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you are serving 6,000 pets annually, 500,000 people over nearly 3,000 square miles, diverse backgrounds. Tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background.
Sure. I always had pets when I was growing up. And in 2011, I was in this crazy car accident and I couldn't work for about 5 years. And during that time, I thought, oh my gosh, I have all this space in my home. I'm home all the time. I'm going to start fostering, and ended up getting connected with an organization up in the Pacific Northwest that did boxer rescue. And I remember so clearly that first time that we got like a van full of dogs coming out of Southern California from some pretty high kill shelters, and just how impactful that was and how much emotion, and ended up working with that rescue for several years, relocated down to California, and Ventura County was hiring their first ever foster coordinator. So I thought, oh my gosh, I can get paid for doing this work that I love so much. And I worked there for about 3 years. After that, I went to Pima County, which is in Arizona. When COVID started, I worked for Greater Good. Greater Good had launched the Stay Home and Foster program at the beginning of COVID, when shelters were worried that they weren't going to have staff and there weren't going to be adopters and what were we going to do? And we cleared out shelters all across the nation. It was absolutely phenomenal. I've been now at Santa Barbara County for about a year and a half. And we have the most amazing community here on the Central Coast. And every day I feel so lucky to be here.
Yeah. And where are those locations around Santa Barbara County?
One is in Orchid, just outside Santa Maria. We have a shelter in Lompoc. And then we have a shelter in Santa Barbara and Goleta. We do a lot of shuffling of dogs between our shelters, and we have been really lucky not to face the overcrowding that's been happening across the state and the nation. It's just been recently that we've started to see continued increase in the number of animals coming in.
I am following you guys on social media, and there was a really sweet dog that caught my eye. I believe his name is Crunch. Tell me about that sweet boy.
Yeah, Crunch was found as a stray, and the finders had him for a couple weeks and had attempted to get him reunited with his family and ultimately brought him into the shelter, which we absolutely encourage everyone to make sure you're reporting found animals to us. The shelter is really scary for him. You know, it's really loud and it's really stressful. And I always say that no matter how nice a shelter is, it's still a shelter.
For sure.
You know, it's not a home.
And I also saw on your website, you have lots more than just cats and dogs at your shelters. And you have a couple pages of bunnies, it looks like right now. And I know we're getting close to Easter and it's a good time to raise some awareness. I mean, bunnies do make great pets, but not for everybody. And of course, it's important to keep them safe and have the appropriate housing.
Just know as you're considering a bunny or a chicken or any live animals as a present, that they do have needs and they will be with you for several years. Easter is a great opportunity to add pets to your family. We just encourage folks to know what they're getting into.
And I think you have a turtle right now as well.
You know, in this last year, we've seen chinchillas, mice, bearded dragons. We got a chameleon. We've had all kinds of birds. But yeah, right now we do have a red-eared slider, and we've got chickens and, of course, dogs and cats.
And how do adoptions work at your shelters?
As a municipal shelter, almost 6,000 animals came in last year. So we try to make adoption as easy as possible. We have open hours from 10 to 6, Tuesday through Sunday. So if you're interested in adopting or meeting some pets, you can just come in. During that time, we do not require appointments. We don't require pre-screening or applying or any of that stuff beforehand. And when you come in, you're more than welcome to take a look around the shelter, or you can meet with one of our staff and they can help you kind of narrow down your options. We're really looking to have a conversation with you and find out about your lifestyle and what are you looking for in a pet. I know for me, a lot of times when I was younger, you know, I'd think, oh, I want a specific breed or a specific look of an animal. And then I would learn about it or I'd meet the pets and I'd be like, oh my gosh, and that's not really what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. And then somebody would say, oh, what about this? This seems like a good match. And I head over heels in love. So I encourage folks to come in, have some conversations. It's not about necessarily meeting requirements so much as we just want to find a good match for you. And with, I think we've got this morning, 150 dogs in our three shelters and another 100 available out of foster homes.
Wow.
So it's a lot. It's a lot of options and it can be overwhelming. So utilize our staff, utilize our volunteers to find what you're looking for.
Yeah, they know them the best.
Absolutely.
We encourage the same. Come in with an open mind and an open heart. Meet several animals. We all have our breed favorites and dogs that we're drawn to by appearances, but meeting them, spending time with them, learning about their energy, their personality, maybe whatever background we do know. Our CEO, Emily LaRue, recently went to a conference and she brought back some stats, and it kind of being in the industry for 10 years and working so hard and being so proud of the work and the progress that we've been able to do, I got to say it hurt my heart a little bit to kind of get some of those stats. Looking at California, of course, this is just like a little snippet of what's really going on, but only 30% of pet owners were choosing adoption still. And I feel like in this area, it's the number one go-to, luckily, but that just made me think bigger picture. We still have a lot of work to do. And we know that all the shelters are overcrowded with great adoptable animals. And then that the most searched tagline was buying puppies, not adopting puppies. And I'm sure you have seen, just like we have seen in other shelters, the huge increase of litters of puppies that we're seeing come our way, moms with puppies. And then the most common breed search to buy was German Shepherds. And that just like broke my heart because we have seen so many great German Shepherds, Shepherd mixes, waiting in shelters for 6 months, 8 months, a year, 2 years. You know, please consider adopting. We have every breed, every size, every age coming through our shelters. And then just really encouraging your friends and family to consider adopting versus buying. I think I live in the shelter world so much that I just assume everybody is adopting. And so when she shared some of those recent stats, it just kind of like took my breath away a little bit. If you're just joining us, you are listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society, and my guest today on Peace, Love, and Pets is Sarah Aguilar, director at Santa Barbara County Animal Services. Are you guys also seeing a big increase in litters of puppies?
We just had two pregnant dogs come in last week.
Okay. And we're also gearing up for kitten season. You're getting ready for kitten season?
Yeah. You know, during COVID, we had this huge decrease in veterinary services, right? We're experiencing a national shortage of veterinarians, and veterinarians are trying to take better care of themselves as well. And so not as accessible as we're used to. And this last year, we saw such a huge increase in the volume of kittens coming in, numbers that we haven't seen ever in the history of our shelter. And trying to care for them is a lot. We need so much help from the community with that, whether it's donating KMR, which is kitten milk replacer, or donating kitten food, donating fleece blankets, fostering, caring for kittens in your home, learning how to bottle feed, you know, all of these things that are required. You know, kittens are too fragile to live in the shelter environment. And their best chance really is to stay with their mom. But if that's not possible, then we rely on foster caregivers to help them survive and make it to adoption. So, you know, unfortunately, I think the number's probably going to continue to go up again this year. We just don't have the resources, not just in our community, but, you know, across the state, across the nation, to keep up and to catch up from that decrease in surgeries for a couple years. So, please get your cats fixed. Mm-hmm. In both our counties, we have Care for Paws. We'll do surgeries, which is a nonprofit group with a mobile spay-neuter unit. Santa Barbara Humane does so many community cat surgeries. Mm-hmm. And
spay and neuter your pets. There's way too many accessible options these days. You know, back in the day, I grew up in a small rural country town. Nobody said the word spay and neuter. I never heard it until I was probably late teens and heard it on The Price is Right. But we have access. We have information. We have programs that can help. So we did talk about fostering. So you're definitely looking for fosters at this time.
We have doggy day trips. So any member of the public can just walk in during our open hours, sign a couple papers, and take a dog home. It's kind of like checking out a library book, right? You can take a dog home for an afternoon, a weekend, and it helps them to get a break from the shelter and also gives us so much information about them. If you're interested in fostering a dog or a cat that doesn't need bottle feeding, kittens that are, you know, about 2 months older or adult cat, you can just come in. All of our animals that are available for adoption are available for foster. If you're interested in learning about bottle feeding, we do offer some training because it can be a little bit tricky. And all of our fosters, we provide all of the food, the medical support, any supplies that you might need that we've got available. All you need to do is just open your heart and your home, which sounds like our theme today, heart and home.
Perfect. Our theme every day, I think, right? And then what about shelter volunteer opportunities?
What kind of volunteer opportunities don't we have?
Okay, good.
We did some calculations recently, and the volume of animals that are coming in, we should have about 24 staff just feeding and cleaning animals on a daily basis. And I've got 14, and that's not every day because some of them need days off, right? So we absolutely rely on volunteers. And it's everything from feeding and cleaning to walking, enrichment, baths, training. It goes beyond animals. We need volunteers to do video editing. I need volunteers to help with administrative tasks. We need volunteers to help us with just property maintenance and planting flowers and making it look nice. As a tax-based entity, we don't have a lot of flexibility with spending or hiring to adapt to the fluctuations in the volume of animals coming in. And so all of those those pieces to getting them seen on social media and talking about them and getting them training and getting them out to adoption events all requires volunteers. And so there's just an unlimited number of opportunities. And I always tell people, whatever your skill is, whatever you like to do, we can use it.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. You don't have to like dogs. You don't have to come in and spend time with animals.
I was a volunteer coordinator at Woods, and I would say, like, if you make eye contact with me, I will find something for you to do. Let us know what your skills are. Let us know what you're willing to give, and we will find a
right?
way to use
you
that.
You want to come play guitar at the shelter? Great.
Awesome.
I love it.
And how do people find out more opportunities and sign up to be a volunteer?
Go on our website. You can do the application. The other thing we do is at each shelter, about twice a month, for folks to come in for sort of like an orientation. You come in and you learn about the shelter, learn about opportunities, take a tour, meet some of the staff, meet some animals, and kind of figure out what it is you want to do. And as soon as that's done, you automatically can start volunteering and assisting. We have all of our forms and paperwork is all encompassed in that online application, so you don't come in and then do another hour worth of paperwork. Sign my paper and I want to instantly be helpful. And so we try to make that the reality for anybody that wants to help us.
If you're just joining us, you are listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society, and my guest today on Peace, Love, and Pets is Sarah Aguilar, director at Santa Barbara County Animal Services. Let's talk a little bit about pet reunification. I'm wondering if a lot of the dogs that you're having at the shelter are found as strays, or what some of the main reasons are for so many pets at your shelter. And let's remind people what to do if they lose a pet and what to do if they find a pet in Santa Barbara County.
About 85% of the animals that come into our shelter come in as strays. So that is a huge volume. Not just dogs and cats that are coming in strays, but rabbits come in strays and tortoises come in strays. And we know from studies that have been done in other places that most stray pets are found within a half mile of their house. The first thing that we encourage folks to do if you find a stray is to just knock on some doors, walk around a little bit and see if anybody recognizes the pet. When you bring them into the shelter, it can create an extra barrier to them going home because it's so much farther away. And we encourage you to just take a little bit of time, knock on some doors, walk around, and see if anyone recognizes a pet, and it can go home immediately. If you don't find the owners, Santa Barbara County law requires that you report it to Animal Services. We have record of that. If people are searching for their lost pet, they can come and look. They know that we'll have information. If you've lost your pet, first thing to do is check on next door, check on social media, and then report it to the animal shelter. So you can go online and complete a lost or a found pet report. We also encourage you to come into the shelter and take a look at the pets that are here, because a picture that we take might not be exactly what your pet looks like or what you think it looks like. Microchips, of course, don't contain actual information about the owner, but they have a number on them that should be in a database. We can look that up in our database as well as like a national registry and call the microchip manufacturer, all kinds of things that we can do to try and reunite pets that have a microchip. And then in Santa Barbara County, our licenses also are linked so that if you find a pet that has a license, owners can be found that way too, and sometimes easier than scanning for a microchip. So we also encourage everybody to have their pets licensed.
Wow. Hopefully we can get some more people to get those collar and ID tags on, get your pets microchipped. Do you have any events coming up or ways people can get involved and participate in, you know, supporting your efforts and your shelter pets?
Yeah, yesterday we just wrapped up our St. Patrick's Day Name Your Price promotion, but we've had such a great response. We're going to go ahead and extend that through the rest of the month. Announce that here.
Woo-woo! Breaking news, everyone.
It's a Name Your Price promotion. So okay. We don't want an adoption fee to be a barrier for pets to go to homes. We know there's great pet owners out there, and we want folks to be able to enjoy the love and companionship of a furry family member or a scaly family member and to just come in, find a pet that's a great match for you and donate what you want to give us for your pet.
So that's going to go for the whole month of March.
We're just going to run
Let's
that through
Let's do it.
All
Let's
month.
Get some animals adopted. And my guest today is Sarah Aguilar, director at Santa Barbara County Animal Services. I always like to remind people it really has a big impact every single time we can even get one more animal adopted. And I love that we are removing barriers and making adoption easy and making registering animals easy. I wanted to finish up with reading something that we share often, you know, working in a shelter for many years. It can get a little exhausting and daunting and emotional, especially these days. But I think if we can all just put this in perspective, I'll just share the starfish story. A young man is walking along the ocean and sees a beach on which thousands and thousands of starfish have washed ashore. He sees an old man walking slowly and stooping often, picking up one starfish after another and tossing each one gently into the ocean. "Why are you throwing starfish into the ocean?" he asks. "Because the sun is up and the tide is going out, and if I don't throw them further in, they will die. But old man, you don't realize there are miles and miles of beach and starfish all along it. You can't possibly save them all. You can't even save one-tenth of them. In fact, even if you work all day, your efforts won't make any difference at all." The old man listened calmly and then bent down to pick up another starfish and threw it into the sea. It made a difference to that one. And that is something that we do and we see and we're a part of every day. And I appreciate your team working so hard for shelter pets. I appreciate what our county in San Luis Obispo County does to help shelter pets. And it is a bit daunting at times. And I know your team of staff and volunteers and supporters are tired. And there's endless amount of animals. We may do a great adoption weekend and get 40 animals adopted in a couple days. And there's a million waiting to take those spots. But it sure does matter for those ones that are getting saved. Sorry. So I want to thank you and your team for what you're doing. And I want our listeners to just be reminded that there is something that everybody can do to help a shelter or rescue near them. Please consider adopting. Please consider fostering. Please consider volunteering. Come to our events. Share our social media posts. I can guarantee you that we need you more now than ever. It is tough right now for our industry. And I really respect and appreciate anybody that's working hard to save pets. So to wrap up, I just want to thank you for listening to Peace, Love, and Pets on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods. And please, please don't forget your new best friend is waiting for you at a shelter.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.